government aid packages is pumped into the economy, more analysts expect a solid recovery to kick in this summer. The incoming Biden administration, along with a now fully Democratic-led House and Senate, will also likely push additional rescue aid and spending measures that, as they claimed, could accelerate economic growth. Economists note that the $2 trillion aid package the government enacted in March, which included generous unemployment benefits and aid to small companies and businesses, did more to prevent layoffs from spending than many analysts had expected. But a big unknown overhangs the 2021 economy. Will the economic recovery come fast enough and be robust enough to absorb many of the Americans who lost their jobs in the hospitality industries into more resilient sectors of the job market? For now, the resurgent pandemic has made consumers reluctant to shop, travel, dine out, and congregate in crowds, and led states and cities to reimpose stricter limits on restaurants. The trend has upended the lives of people like Brad Pierce of West Warwick, Rhode Island, in New York. Brad Pierce had gradually built up a career as a stand-up comedian, only to see it derailed by the pandemic and restrictions in the places that he performed. Now he wonders if that life will ever return. Even when the centers where Brad Pierce worked had reopened, they couldn't offer live entertainment because of coronavirus restrictions. He fears some of these venues won't survive. Brad Pierce receives about $500 a week in unemployment aid, and his wife still works as a healthcare technician, busier than ever because she administers COVID-19 tests. Though he feels fortunate financially, the contrast sometimes depresses him. Brad Pierce, a 40-year-old, said, "She's working all the time whilst I can't work, and it's a terrible feeling as a husband and a spouse." In the meantime, there have been odd gigs for him here and there. The weirdest was a stand-up routine he did by Zoom for a company's holiday party. He asked the employees to unmute so he could hear them laughing, only to be hit by a cacophony of dogs barking, kids yelling, and television sets blaring. He spent the rest of the gig watching his audience silently, moving lips to see if they might be laughing. Brad Pierce said, "I have days where I think I will come back, and days where I think, well, I guess I'll never work again." Hirschbein and Holzer's research found that job losses have been deeper among blacks and Hispanic workers than among whites, and also more pronounced for those in lower-paying jobs. Hirschbein found employment amongst the lowest-paid one-quarter of Americans has sunk nearly 12% since February of this year. Among the highest-paid quarter, it's declined less than 3.5%. Hirschbein said the proportion of white Americans with jobs has fallen 6% since the pandemic. Among black and Hispanic Americans, it's down 10%. This means that at some portion of the pandemic, job losses become permanent. Non-white workers will be hurt the most. Michelle Holder, an economist at John Jay College, noted that the two biggest sources of job losses amongst black women have been cashiers at stores and restaurants, including fast food outlets and in childcare. She said she fears that many of those jobs likely won't return, even as the pandemic fades away, as some shifts in the economy become permanent. Business travel won't likely return to its previous levels as more meetings are conducted remotely. Many healthcare appointments are now held online, thereby reducing the need for some staffers in doctors' offices. That may end a decades-long narrowing of the black-white unemployment gap, given that many lower-paid jobs are disproportionately held by black workers. Michelle Holder said, "There are significant changes coming in terms of where we work, what jobs will be available," she added. "All this will hit women, low-wage workers, and people of color. As the pandemic recession rages on, more small businesses have been forced to close. This trend threatens to become a long-term drag on the job market because new companies will have to be created to absorb many laid-off workers." David Gilbertson, Vice President at UKG, a company that makes employee time management software, said among his firm's clients with fewer than 100 employees in March, 13% have now closed, more than double the figure in a typical year. Another round of small business loans included in the $900 billion aid package approved last month will be crucial to help prevent another wave of closings. David Gilbertson said they've made it this far and now they're on the brink of having to close down. In the meantime, the struggling jobless include people who have forged independent careers, people like Brian Blue, who quit his job as an equipment repairman in Kansas City a year ago to become a full-time musician in Las Vegas, Nevada. Before the pandemic, Blue typically played bass guitar in bands at venues several nights a week. He isn't sure that Vegas music scene will ever return to what it was. Blue, who hasn't played a gig since March, is now wrestling with whether to give up hope of rebuilding his music career. For now, he's working as a delivery driver for a sandwich shop, earning $9 an hour before tips. He receives unemployment benefit depending on how much he earns with his job in a given week. Blue, a 46-year-old, said, "Time will tell, I guess. It's been a difficult pill to swallow."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhbakhna Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the Constitution.
They wrote one article of the Constitution.
There's a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it's interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married and they have their first babies. They both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab.
She wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, mm-hmm. whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic. Which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks a lot about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that they are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it, but they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch on that a bit later on. Yeah.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste. This harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be Emna, who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke, he goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes. the others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually a very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting because she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually fund, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is, I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR exercise, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary now. It was Emna who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces. Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Oh, really? Why is that?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little, like nothing, about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the points that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And, you know, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary, I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Johara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. I know, can you explain that?
Yes, I want to ask Catherine, well, actually. Could you give us
Well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. And the sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Johara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how we have to smash the terrorist stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was.
So facing the Muslims and the secular.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't it just the Muslim problem?
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film. And Johara says, this is awful. This is not what my father taught me. This is not what is in the Quran. We must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum next to the parliament. And especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then, okay, we have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part, and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? You know, it's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? We saw briefly there was an issue of terrorism. Yeah.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off, and it's a blueprint, but, you know, it's a compounding of everything, all the issues that, you know, other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, you know, the discussion, you know, secularism, Islamism, what do we do, could we find, you know, another way? And, you know, I think her silence, you know, speaks volume, really, and it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of, you know, radicalism? What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, you know, here's Islam, but, you know, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, you know, preaches, you know, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, you know, is this attempt to have pluralism. And this is what I heard, you know, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they live to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, you know, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. You know, and I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media. You know, that kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. You know, even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes. Yes.
We're nearing the end of the film and this program now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to have seen in the documentary also?
What would I... well, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Juwara was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly, when the president, or was he the prime minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election, suddenly the constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would
criticise. Would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
Oh, yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Variant 501 Y.V2 is believed to be behind a fast-growing coronavirus outbreak in South Africa's Eastern Cape province. Researchers first identified the variant in October 2020 in Nelson Mandela Bay, South Africa. According to a preliminary data on the strain, samples of the variant carry up to 9 changes to the spike protein. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Nicole Carlis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New COVID Variant Found in South Africa Raises Concerns Over Impacts on Vaccine. Here's the details of this article. Naturally, the coronavirus mutates as it spreads, but scientists are more concerned about some mutations more than others. And there is one in particular that's worrisome because it could throw a wrench in future vaccine efficacy, specifically variant 2C501Y.V2, also known as B.1.351 lineage, which has emerged in Durban, South Africa, is alarming because the mutation of the virus is at the SARS-CoV-2 spike, disguising its appearance to the immune system, which can make it easier to bypass immune protection. Think of it like someone putting a wig to go to a party they weren't invited to and tricking the bouncer by changing their appearance to enter. The concern is that it has a structural change that may change the shape of the spike protein in a way that it may not be as easily recognized by the immune system, which means the antibodies that we raise through vaccination, as well as naturally occurring antibodies following an infection, explained Dr. George Rutherford, a professor of epidemiology at the University of California, San Francisco. That's the concern with that strain. Dean Blomberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Associate Professor in Department of Pediatrics at the University of California, Davis, agreed. We need to be immune to that spike protein to prevent infection. If it changes, if it mutates too much, then maybe we might lose immunity that we've achieved via either infection or immunization, Blomberg said. Variant 501, Y.V2, is believed to be behind a fast-growing coronavirus outbreak in South Africa's Eastern Cape province. Researchers first identified the variant in October 2020 in Nelson Mandela Bay, South Africa. In December 2020, it was also identified in Zambia and appeared to be the dominant strain in the country. According to a preliminary data on the strain, samples of the variant carry up to 9 changes to the spike protein. One mutation of 501Y.V2 that is of concern is N501Y because of how the portion of the spike is mutated. A second mutation, dubbed E45K, appears to have changed the shape of the protein in a way that is making it harder for some antibodies to neutralize the virus. There are preliminary studies that suggest that people who have previously been infected with previous strains, they may neutralize the virus up to 10 times less, Blomberg said, so that it's a concern that would suggest maybe vaccine-induced immunity may be escaped by this new variant in South Africa. Indeed, a paper published about this specific mutation recently echoed those concerns. One author of the paper told Stat News that despite findings that the virus was harder to neutralize with antibodies from other strains, the variant would have to have very specific mutations in certain spots to have a big impact on vaccine efficacy. According to a separate report published recently, scientists tested a vaccine against N501Y using blood samples from 20 people. Fortunately, the vaccination worked on them, but the sample size was far too small to say definitively that it would be true for the general population. Does this strengthen the case that COVID-19 vaccines will be similar to the flu vaccine? In the sense that they will be tailored to different strains and more frequent? Maybe yes, maybe no, Rutherford said. But it would be quite unusual if we had to go in and change it rapidly. The Centers for Disease and Control, CDC, has warned that the potential consequence of these mutations could be that these variants could evade vaccine immunity, but that it would not be an immediate impact. Both vaccination against a natural infection with SARS-CoV-2 produce a polyclonal response that targets several parts of the spike protein, states the CDC. The virus would likely need to accumulate multiple mutations in the spike protein to evade immunity induced by vaccines or by natural infection. Masking and social distancing still work to protect people from this strain, which hasn't been identified in other countries yet. According to reports, it has been identified in Austria, Norway, and Japan. Notably, there is no evidence to suggest that any of the mutations of this variant cause more serious illness. Currently, there is no evidence that these variants cause more severe illness or increased risk of death, the CDC states. New information about the virologic, epidemiologic, and clinical characteristics of these variants is rapidly emerging.
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S. Violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups will often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. Five people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. When you look at the numbers of people who were rioters who worked their way into the Capitol, this is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened to the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warned his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the Vice President and Cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment, but the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That too is politically complicated and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the Vice President who was working his way around the President, actually excluding the President from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the US. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major US towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the US government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognising when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, Abdulhamid points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counterterrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud, and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system and that the event showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, and we profess to be the bastion of democracy, but the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years. But that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. The Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, the Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given in to any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor, Jared Kushner, said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is, as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
After 4 norm-shattering years of Trump, it took just a few hours of mob rule to make America look pretty ordinary and as fragile as anywhere else. In Latin American countries, including Venezuela, where the U.S. has imposed sanctions and supported efforts to oust President Nicolas Maduro in recent years, and also in Colombia, leaders expressed shock that the U.S. is suffering what it has generated in other countries with its politics of aggression, as the Venezuelan government said in a statement. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Julia Conley Ryder, published under the heading Myth of Exceptionalism Shattered as Globe Expresses Shock Over Day of Shame for American Democracy. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article.